In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Yeah.
Let's all go to the lobby.
Yes, indeed. Hey, let's talk movies. By the way, speaking of movies, Pass the Popcorn brought to you by our friends at Bangor Mall Cinema and the Bangor Drive-In, which is opening up on the 21st.
Drive-in season once again.
I know, and coming up next week, we'll talk with Scott Warren and get a little preview of what's going on at the drive-in. So pretty cool. Alan Adams from The Main Edge joins us to talk movies. Hello there, Al.
Hello, sir. How are you?
Very good, thank you. How was the weekend and all that?
It was great. You know, we had the pretty good weather, which was nice. You know, did some Mother's Day stuff with my mom.
Nice.
Like you do. Got out, played some disc golf this weekend. It was a pretty good one, all things considered.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. And here we are in a brand spanking new week and living large and a couple of movies to talk about. And I know very little about either one, but I'm very intrigued by your description. So, anyway, what do you want to go with?
Let's start with the Guy Ritchie, Jason Statham team-up, Wrath of Man.
Oh, wait, I thought they did Street Gang, How We Got to Sesame Street, which would have been awesome.
That would be a very complicated movie, but one I think that we could all find some enjoyment in.
Yes.
So Wrath of Man, it's Guy Ritchie directs, Jason Statham stars. Now, these guys have been, they've collaborated a number of times in the past. One could argue that Guy Ritchie is the reason that we even know who Jason Statham is. Between his work on Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, Snatch, even the lesser Ritchie light Revolver from 2005, like those three movies particularly the first two were very much a sort of an introduction of Jason Statham to American audiences, and he's become one of the biggest action stars out there. And I think one could make the case that had he not established this relationship with Guy Ritchie, that wouldn't have happened. That being said, they haven't done anything together in 15 years. Like Revolver was in 2005,
wow.
And this is the they hadn't teamed up since. So it's really interesting to sort of see these two guys come together. And to be fair, 15 years is a long time, but in terms of evolution, I don't know that either guy has really changed all that much. And so one gets the impression of two old friends. You know those friendships where you don't speak for a long time and then you're back together and you just fall into the old patterns again.
Yeah,
that's what this movie is, for better or worse. Like it basically boils down to if you like what Guy Ritchie does, which is basically focus on a bunch of lowlifes and criminals, and their sort of varying degrees of amorality with regards to their behavior. Like if that's what you're into, then you're gonna dig this movie just like you're gonna dig pretty much any Guy Ritchie movie. This one again, titled Wrath of Man. It's based on a 2004 French film called Le Convoyeur, it is. Sorry about that. you wouldn't guess watching this movie that it had been 15 years since they had worked together, because that energy and that sensibility is still going very strong.
Hey, Stella! Stella!
I know, right? Again, I'm very sorry.
What's she doing? What's got her all wound up?
Oh, Sheridan has just arrived home.
Okay.
She's letting her know.
Well, I'm surprised you're not reacting the same.
Well, I will do that from time to time. So the movie, Jason Statham plays this guy named Patrick Hill, and he's looking for a job working for a cash truck company in L.A., like one of these companies that basically has armored cars that transport money, from place to place. private security type deal. And this particular company is sort of is really looking for new employees. They're reeling. They've had a recent robbery that left a number of people dead, including two of their guards. And so they need qualified candidates. He's on the borderline, but they take him on. He's quickly given a nickname. They call him H by his coworker Bullet, played by the wonderful that guy Holt McCallany. And we meet a number of the sort of various private security weirdos who work there, and they all have weird names, like as people tend to do in Guy Ritchie movies. Like Josh Hartnett's here; he plays a guy named Boy Sweat Dave, which it's never explained why he's called Boy Sweat Dave, which kind of makes it better. And then other guys, like there's a guy named Hollow Bob. Like this is the kind of thing we're talking about. So this company is responsible for transporting like tens of millions of dollars across LA, like every day. And after this recent incident, everyone's on high alert. But then there's a robbery attempt on H's first day on the job. The robbery team, led by the way, by a guy played by Post Malone, because of course Post Malone is here. Why not? but it essentially ends with H methodically and efficiently dispatching every single one of the robbers, and that starts to raise some questions. For instance, where did this guy come from, and what does he want? And meanwhile, there's a heist being planned, a really big one. And while neither that crew nor H realizes it, they're on this sort of collision course. We'll just, whatever happens next, it's anyone's guess. Now, it's hard to go on from here in terms of plot, because a lot of the movie is spent sort of moving back and forth chronologically, like up back and forth, up and down the timeline. And which divulges more and more information regarding the situation as it plays out. And there are a lot of reveals in this movie. You might see some of them coming. I didn't, though I probably should have. But there's a lot of fun to be had from experiencing them in the moment, so I'm not going to go into too many specifics. But look, like, it's obvious that there's going to be more to this guy. I mean, it's Jason Statham, So that, of course, is going to play in mightily to how the story develops. And through that sort of drip of revelation, we're kind of brought into this wider world of criminality. It's broken into chapters. Each chapter has its title, and it's all intended to sort of open the window a little bit more. Now, Wrath of Man is not a particularly sophisticated movie. It's well executed and has a very strong awareness of what it is and what it means to be. But, I mean, at its core, it's Guy Ritchie doing Guy Ritchie things. He's showing us terrible people being terrible to each other in very visceral and brutal ways. And it's fun. It's a lot of fun. Like, there are issues. Like, the back-and-forth nature of the timeline, it's mostly effective, but there are stretches where it kind of takes a minute to realize where exactly you are in the narrative. And some of those leaps are brief in terms of how much time has passed. So that blurs the chronology a little bit and makes keeping track a little tough, particularly when you take into account the fairly thin nature of the plot in the first place. But there's no faulting the action side of things. Like, and that's where you're really reminded of how simpatico Guy Ritchie and Jason Statham are. It's a little more straightforward than the sort of stylized stuff that Ritchie usually does. But it's that sort of kinetic unexpectedness is still there. It doesn't matter if it's fists, guns, or whatever. Like, it all works, and it works really well. And the heist side of things is also really good. You get the planning, the prep, the execution. Like, it's kind of standard, but it gets a little bump thanks to some really good actors. Jeffrey Donovan is here, and he's great. Scott Eastwood, who's hit or miss for me, but he's really going for it here, and it works. And again, Jason Statham is just, like, he's being Jason Statham. Like, that's what he does. Like, he's the same type of dude he plays in just about every movie. But that's the thing about it. He's just so good at being Jason Statham that it works. I mean, that type of guy is a perfect fit for a certain type of film. And, and frankly, you could Statham in pretty much anything from a franchise blockbuster to a lo-fi indie. We've seen it done. There's less winking in this movie than we kind of tend to see from him. He basically just puts a dour look on his face at the top and just keeps it there. But it works. Supporting cast, it's an interesting group. The sorts of sleazy oddballs that Guy Ritchie loves to bring into the picture. But yeah. Oh, and before I forget, There's the biggest surprise in terms of casting. There are a fair number of familiar faces, but Andy Garcia randomly pops up in a couple of scenes as like a federal investigator, like just kind of out of nowhere. It's like, oh, hey, it's Andy Garcia. Ultimately, whether you like this movie or you don't, and I did, this is undeniably the film that it wants to be. Like, it basically relies on, you know, some gleefully rendered violence and the basic blunt force charisma of Jason Statham to overcome what flaws it has. And for the most part, it does. Like, it's exactly what you'd expect from Guy Ritchie. And to my mind, that's a good thing.
We're talking with Alan Adams of The Main Edge here on Downtown. From Wrath of Man on to Street Gang, how we got to Sesame Street?
I was always, like, I'm in the bag for this movie just from the title, you know. Like, I grew up on Sesame Street, and I'm hardly alone on that. Like, generations of children have spent, you know, large chunks of their formative years engaging with the sort of, you know, unique blend of education and entertainment that basically sprang onto public television, like, fully formed in the late 60s. Like, you know, you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone out there who doesn't have at least a passing awareness of Sesame Street. And the reality is that sort of pervasive kind of cultural omnipresence, it's a thing of the past. Like, there's just so much striation and stratification in content that the potential footprint of any one project is just greatly reduced. But even with that said, it's undeniable that Sesame Street is an important touchstone for just millions of people. And so Street Gang, how we got to Sesame Street, it's a new documentary about the show, specifically the first 20 years or so of the show, and basically attempts to break down the origins of this phenomenon. Like, it's a look into how the project came to be, and it features all these interviews, both new and archival, with kind of the primary figures responsible for making it all happen. And now, this is a movie that could easily have coasted on nostalgia, like, just because, like, I mean, like I said, I was in the bag from the word go. Like, there's so many, and like, I'm not alone. Like, that nostalgia is inspired by just the mere mention of the show. And again, by arguing, you know, by ending the story when it does, it essentially ends roughly around the same time that Jim Henson passed away. It basically avoids some of the thornier aspects of the show's later years. But again, that said, this is not a rose-colored look at the show's history. Like, the first two decades are treated pretty honestly. Like, there's a deep dive ethos to it that focuses on embracing the positive aspects and the not so positive aspects alike. It's really interesting to watch because it's hard to believe, considering how successful it eventually became. But I mean, it was far from a given at the beginning. Like, and I learned a lot about the origins of the show from watching this. Like, the fact that the show only exists because there was this chance meeting between a psychologist, an academic named Lloyd Morissette, and the TV producer Joan Ganz Cooney. Like, that was it. Like, if that meeting doesn't happen, the show doesn't happen. So these two people, each notable in their field, kind of saw the potential of overlapping their spheres, because children's television had long been driven by commercial forces, and it suffered in terms of quality because of that. But their take, and it's so simple, and it's so inspiring, it's so brilliant, was basically this. What if those same commercial techniques were adapted to advance educational themes? Like, basically, what if a TV show sold kids education instead of products? And, you know, it was such an idea. It was so novel that no one had any idea how to do it. But through the collaborative efforts of people like Morissette and Cooney, they brought on veteran TV director John Stone, a couple of great songwriters, and Christopher Cerf and Joe Raposo, and, of course, the you know, weirdo of a puppeteer named Jim Henson. You know, all these people come together, and this half-century television mainstay is born. Like I said, it seems obvious in hindsight. Like, kids absorbed, they still do absorb so much information from these commercials. So why not pattern our information that we want them to absorb in the same way? You know, sell them letters and numbers the way companies were selling beer and cars to their parents. And that's why Jim Henson is there in the first place.
Right.
Like, it's not out of any sort of educational, like, altruism. I mean, he obviously cared about that stuff. But because he and the Muppets had already proved they were able to create these funny and memorable commercials. Whether it's the Wilkins coffee spots or what have you, like it was just like that's what got him into the room. And so we're walked through this the early years. We see the process through which the show kind of came to life, and you're hearing from these pivotal figures all throughout, both in terms of like present day interviews and especially the archival stuff, because that gives us insight not only from people who are not necessarily with us any longer, but it gives us the perspective of people who were making the show while they were making the show. And it's all this behind the scenes stuff, like seeing these snippets of the show being made as it was happening, like watching, like just seeing footage of Jim Henson and Frank Oz, like, you know, doing Bert and Ernie, you know what I mean? with the whole shebang, like seeing that happen and watching the evolution of the various characters, whether we're talking about Flesh and Blood or Felt, like it's just fascinating to watch, you know. And they talk to the actors who populated the street, as well as, you know, a number of clips reminding us of just how wide ranging the guest performers on that show have always been. And, you know, it's nostalgic for sure, but they're a lot more frank than I kind of was expecting. Like just stuff like that I didn't really know about specifically. The one story that really stood out in that respect was the recasting of Gordon, the role of Gordon, which was originally played by an actor named Matt Robinson before he was replaced by Roscoe Orman, who is the Gordon that I think most of us are familiar with. Matt Robinson created basically the first specifically like black Muppet in the early 1970s for the show, a character by the name of Roosevelt Franklin. And that character proved so controversial, it was kind of phased out, which ultimately led to Robinson's departure as well. So it's just like this, you know, that's kind of an unfortunate story, the way it played out. You know, and of course, the highlights are Legion. Like, you know, it's not easy being green. How did that come about? The story about, like, the executives are having an early meeting, and everybody thinks that, you know, Henson is just some random hippie who wandered in off the street. Like, nobody knows who he is. Stuff about the Jim Henson Frank Oz dynamic, the iconic you know, sort of sequence where they talked about the death of Mr. Hooper, which while watching this I learned I'm apparently still upset about it. You know, and it just, the list goes on and on. And you know, we end the story in the early 90s, so we don't get the unfortunate ubiquity of Elmo and the corporatization of the show, like shifting to HBO and stuff like that. But by focusing on the first two decades, we're able to get a much more nuanced and thorough portrait of the show's sort of rise and its ultimate impact on the culture. Like, look, I love this movie. Like, telling the story of an iconic institution can be problematic, you know, and I understand the temptation to maybe veer into hagiography a little bit. But the filmmakers really do a great job of treating this subject with honesty and accepting the show's imperfection. Basically, it just makes the glorious nature of Sesame Street, to my mind, just shine out all the brighter.
Cool. Well, now I really want to see it. Sounds great. Thank you, Al.
Hey, my pleasure, man.
Hey, how close are you to your fully vaccinated state?
I'm 46 hours away.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Carrie says once you're there, which is very soon, if you want to grace our presence again, because we're all fully vaccinated here, you're welcome to return to the studio.
Oh.
I know.
Well, that's something to consider, isn't it?
And you don't have to commit to that today, but we're here.
I do miss your ugly mugs, that's for sure.
Tell me about it, yeah.
Yes, okay. I hadn't, you know, it's funny. It hadn't even occurred to me. Like, it's just like so many things are changing. Just like, and it's just like, oh, right. I can sort of venture back out into the world in something resembling normalcy. It's
right?
Very exciting.
Right. I mean, we can't hold hands and kiss yet, but we're close.
Don't tease me like that, Rick.
I know. It's terrible. I'm glad Stella has calmed down. Always a treat to talk with you, my friend. Let's do it again Wednesday, if that works.
Yeah, we'll talk on Wednesday.
You got it. Thanks, Al. Alan Adams, Main Edge, talking movies on Pass the Popcorn.